One, two, three. Toast.
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 Impossible toast. Mission Impossible toast. Hello, everyone. Hello, everyone. I got to say, that's the most original when I ask somebody for an audio check. And he starts doing the Mission Impossible toast. Toast. That was good. It was really good. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the new Attack of Opportunity. I am GM Jeff Ball, your host. And today we are looking at a different type of content creator. Sure, it has some geeky D&D-ish and sci-fi-ish in mind, you know, when you have a close look at his content. But I reached out to this artist on Twitter because not only does he do a tabletop RPG comic about friends around a table playing said RPG, the artist's style and some of the situation he puts them in are close to home. They're gonna be close to home to you. You got to check this guy out. I am speaking today with the one, the only, I mean, he didn't meet Ethan Hunt's Impossible Mission team, so I think he just kind of went off and became an artist. David J. Bishop, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
So I don't know if you guys remember those old commercials where, like, we're talking to Michael J. Fox and they just find some guy legally named Michael J. Fox. Is apparently, you know, there's another David Bishop out there that does several comics. And
my arch nemesis, yes.
Yeah. When I talked to him, he said, no, you want this guy. I mean, I'm big, but David J. is going to be so much bigger than me in the long run. So I interview him. So I said, okay, Mr. Bishop, and I reached out to you. And that's how it happened right before I woke up. No, shout out to David Bishop, who is a fine UK artist doing Judge Dredd and Doctor Who comics.
Doctor Who,
yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. Just got to keep that in mind. But we have the one and only David J. Bishop, and we're talking about him and his comic strip, his web comic, and I found it on Twitter, and I just absolutely fell in love with this. Now, I might be a little impartial. I mean, my daughter actually started her own webcomic called Something Familiar, and she just started doing cameos in our evil campaign, The Pathfinder Hell's Vengeance. So, you know, shout out to my little girl and, you know, pushing all this kind of stuff. And it made me realize that I was so focused on the podcast community because there's so many of them, everything. And I really enjoyed when I talked to a music creator. I really enjoy when I talk to someone different. And it hit me that I haven't talked to any of the artists, you know, you reach out to them and it's like, I'm close commissions. You know, I'm so busy. Like, it is really hard to track someone like yourself down. So again, thank you so much for taking the time today, sir. But our first question that we always like to ask our victims here on Attack of Opportunity is, David, may I call you David?
You said he may.
Okay. How did you first know that you were a geek, a nerd, one of us, one of us?
The first time that I realized I was a geek was when I tried to sit with some of my friends, for lunch. I was 12 years old and there was another guy at the table, and his dad was famous, so you know that he was better than me, and he said, you can't sit with us, this table is no geeks. And I was heartbroken, and I turned to my friends and said, you know, can I sit with you? But they just silently shook their heads. So I had to go, and I had to sit, little 12 year old me had to go and sit by himself.
Oh,
and
man.
Eat dinner by himself. And then I immediately thought, well, screw those guys. I'm going to make some friends who aren't going to, like, discriminate against me because I'm a geek. I'm going to, if those guys won't let me sit with them, they're not my real friends. And screw that other guy and his famous dad. And then and that's what I did. I decided I was going to stop being friends with those other guys because they were fair weather friends. And I made a really good friend. And actually, we are still friends now, 21 years later, and that's when I started to self-identify as a geek. I think I've always been into that world of things, but it's he was the one who got me into some really nerdy things. He introduced me to my first webcomic. He DM'd my first D&D game. My friend Jason, he was my gateway drug to the world of geekery. It was very much like he was initiating me, and I was like the neophyte, and he like took me under his wing and just showed me this whole world of geeky things. And that's when I first realized that that's what I was, and I've been self-identifying as a geek ever since then. I kind of you know, taking the word back. You know, it's our word.
Awesome.
You know?
I would track down the famous dude, the famous dad, and I wouldn't give him shit. I'd thank him. I'm like, thank you. Because you're such a godhole, you know. And
yeah, I bet him no ill will. That's why I'm not.
Think about it. You got to look at this positive light. This guy showed you the metal of your supposed friends. If he wasn't there, you could have gotten in deep with these guys, and so it could have been far worse. You could have been far older before they, you know, went off, or you discovered they were fair weather friends. I call this guy up and go, thank you, because of you. You know, I know these guys are not worth my time, and you've got, you know, someone really, really cool. And you're like, oh, that's an amazing story. I think that's got to be like one of the best answers to that question ever. He's read how out of the gate, ladies and gentlemen. That's awesome.
Okay, I've started strong, but there's going to be like precipitous drops from this point forward. This is going to be...
No, that's brilliant. I love that. So you've already answered my second question about like a gateway drug. It sounds like your relationship with this guy, and he got you into play and stuff, just kind of, you know, launched you into the world of geeky. Now this is where things get fun for me. Is you're playing D&D? Was there anything else? Because usually it's like, oh, was there anything inspiring you? You know, is my set of questions. And of course, we're always leading up to like, what made you start creating content? And it's usually like a podcast. So we're going to go in a different direction with you. So even though you've kind of glossed over this, I want to re-ask you, was there any other gateway drug? Was there any other thing that influenced you as an artist in the beginning besides playing D&D with Jason? Hi, Jason. thanks, Jason. Like a video game, cosplay, card games, TV. Myself, it was movies for fantasy, sci-fi, you know, that not just kept RPG as a hobby, but obviously influenced you enough to.
Yeah. Well, for me, what got me into cartoons was Disney movies, and they are predominantly fantasy movies. I mean, that is the genre of a lot of those. So a lot of people think of it as kind of like synonymous. So when you think of Disney, you don't think of like Oliver and Company. You think of like The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and all the ones based on fairy tales. So again, that's a very kind of gateway drug. And then you move on to harder stuff. So then I went to my school library and I said, I would like a book, please, of things that are made up. And she was like, so you mean fiction? And I was like, no, I mean, when it's set somewhere where there's dragons and things, and I didn't even know what to call it. And she was like, "Oh, you mean fantasy?" I was like, "Well, no, not fantasy. You know, don't belittle this. It's not like ooh, you know. But can we dragons? The really realistic dragons, please." And then she was like, "Well, you could try Terry Pratchett over there." So then I started reading all of the Terry Pratchett books. I got them out of my school library. They had all of them, and I borrowed every single Terry Pratchett book that had been published and read them all. And then when I finished those, I read all of the David Eddings books. So weirdly, like the guy writing parodies of Lord of the Rings and of D&D, he was the OG in my head. So for me, fantasy really has to be funny. That's sort of my baseline expectation. So when you see a version of it where nobody sings and nobody cracks a joke, I'm just like, interesting take, bold choice. This is a very subversive twist on the genre. It's, so I've got everything completely backwards, really.
Now, I only know Terry Pratchett through the movies they made, like The Color of Magic and stuff. And it's funny, like I just plugged my daughter, Alex, and her comic. She loves Terry Pratchett. We'll be driving in the car, and she's like, "Dad, you got to hear this." And she'll pop out a Terry Pratchett book, and she starts talking about death. And the way Terry Pratchett does the Grim Reaper is got to be the funniest thing I have ever heard. Where
it's fantastic.
He's like the White Rabbit from Alice in Wonderland, but completely not in a hurry. You know, I mean, there's bit in the books where death has an appointment. He's coming to a town to, you know, take someone, and somebody that's on his list, the main character, this magician, runs into him. And because he's a wizard, he can see death. And death is like, "Oh, it's you. Well, you know, save a little time. You could just come with me." And he's like, "No, I don't want to die. Get out. Get away from me, man. Jeez, get off of me." He's like, "Oh, come on, please. I'd be willing to, like, you know, to get you, I'd be willing to put off other appointments," kind of thing. And it's really good stuff. This is the guy that says, if you guys remember the sci-fi of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. and the narrator would talk about, well, this is the way the world is. You know, these people are going to put a space highway through Earth, and this is the way it is. And it's all very, you know, very fun British tongue in cheek. This is a guy who talks about the world is on the back of a giant, enormous turtle in space. And on this turtle are four enormous elephants, and they are holding up the world. You know, the whole round theory is wrong, and you see water spilling off the edge. And it's just, you know, it's a slow, steady roll for Pratchett, but it's so worth it once you kind of just relax and get into that guy's groove. Really good stuff. Sorry. I was just really surprised because I've never had anyone mention Pratchett before.
Yeah. Well, those early books do start off very Douglas Adamsy in tone. Mm. And I've got a book called The Art of the Discworld, where it's got beautiful art by the guy who does the covers. And then commentary by the late Sir Terry. And he said that he made the decision to set the world on elephants and on a disc just to kind of clue people into the fact that this was just a wacky, crazy world where anything can happen. Just kind of like a nudge to the audience. Like, this is going to be something completely different. But then as you go along with the books, they become... The first two books are about the Discworld. Like, they go to the edge of the world and they actually, you know, they do all of the things that you would expect. And then after that, it starts just settling into being historical fantasy, alternate reality kind of satire, where it's more about things like, why do we have free press? Why do we have money? Why do we have gender equality? And he'll pick a theme and he'll just kind of riff on it. And he just starts writing crazy things like murder mysteries in a fantasy setting that is really solid, well-written murder mysteries where you can follow along and you can kind of, and the magic doesn't break the mystery. It's just, it still works. And yeah, it stops being parody and starts becoming satire. And that's when it really kind of grows a beard and becomes really good. Mm. But yeah, it's one of those weird things where every time they do a TV adaptation, no matter where it kind of falls in that timeline of the books he's written, they always kind of open on a shot of the elephants and the turtle. And it's like, yeah, you know, it's, I get your point, but it's kind of like if you started every D&D campaign with like a tavern and then there's a dragon, it's like, yeah, you know, but there's more to it than that, you know.
So much more. Obviously, this writer's had a huge influence on your work, and I didn't mean to get us both off on a tangent here. So let's get to the big question. What made you decide to start making your content? And I guess we have to kind of go back and talk about you doodling, you in school, you were you drawing, were you sketching for your campaign? Like, what got you drawing?
I've always been drawing since I was a child. I remember drawing a picture of Tom and Jerry when I first started school. I was we call it reception, but you might also call it kindergarten in your earth tongue. I was in kindergarten and I drew a picture of Tom and Jerry, and I used a gray felt tip pen for Tom and a brown one for Jerry, and they were just like little stick figures with just like circles for heads. Mm-hmm. But I was so pleased with myself that I drew the right number of legs on the cat and I used a gray pen, and I was like, yeah, this is canonically Tom and Jerry. And I was so pleased. And so I just kind of, I never grew out of that. I never grew out of drawing in that childlike way. I never went to art school. I've had some training in how to do art properly in art lessons at school, but I hated it. And I was kind of good at it, but I hated it. And my art teacher was always trying to get me to stop drawing cartoons. He was like, you know, and if you talk to someone who's like really good at drawing, they'll be like, okay, so you'll reach different stages in your development. Eventually you're going to get out of line dependency, you know, and start creating forms and start painting light as it interacts with forms. And I'm like, nope, lines. I'm just going to do nothing but lines. It's going to be smiley faces and lines. So I'm like, look at these beautiful lines I made, you know? So I've just, my art style is just very much tied to, is it never growing out of that single phase where you
original,
just draw cartoons.
This original Tom and Jerry picture, is it still up on mom's fridge? Do you mind if I call your mom? Here, just give me 1 minute. I'm going to call your mom and see if it's still in the fridge here.
Yeah.
Yes, It's still in the fridge. Oh yeah.
There you go. There you go. Right from Miss Bishop. Okay. So sorry.
she's a classy lady, and I'm lucky to have her.
Yes. Hi, Mom. Sorry. So you've been drawing forever, and what decided for you to pick your medium as the comic strip and then shift that medium to the webcomic, or did you just jump right into the actual digital art?
I pretty much jumped right into digital art. I had a Garfield book, and that's when I fell in love with the comic strip as a format. My grandfather had some really old comic books. I wish I had them now. They were called Dandy.
I thought you were going to say Andy Cap because you got the cap.
yeah, that was the origin. There is a Dandy comic that everyone kind of knows in the UK. It's like there's the Beano and the Dandy, but there was another even older Dandy from like the 1930s about a baby called Dandy. And they were just like these beautiful 3-panel comic strips with like no words at all, barely any words. There would just be to see these really brilliantly well-made gags. And I just completely loved that. But then I very quickly fell in love with web comics when I read PvP by Scott Kurtz. And that is a really good comic. And what appealed to me the most was that it had a more adult tone. So it was geared towards, I mean, at the time I was a teenager, so it was geared towards my sort of emerging adult sensibilities. So it wasn't, it was the first thing after The Simpsons where it was like cartoons aren't just for kids. It was like round about that time we had The Simpsons and South Park, and then for me, PvP. And then I was like, oh wow, you can just make these yourself. And so that was very exciting. And so from that point onwards, I just wanted to be a web cartoonist. So then when I was 16, I started making the comic. And when I was 17, I published it on the internet. And that comic is still on the website now. It's very rough. Those early comics are very rough, and I can't even look at them now. But people say they like it because you can see how the art style evolves over time. But it's a real... the real evolution.
Well, that's good. Yeah. That's good. And quite humbling. Like you gotta look at the early stuff and like look how far I've come. Kind of, you know, if someone's asking about, because we have multiple podcasts, they're like, which one should I listen to first? Maybe I should listen to your oldest one. I'm like, ah, the audio. Especially episode 2 is terrible. We were, you know, watch something new. Please fall in love with the new stuff and then go back if you really got it, you know. Yeah, no.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I would like people to read the latest storyline if they like that. Maybe like read one from 5 years ago and then work your way back forwards. And if you really like that, then start again from the beginning. But please be gentle because, I was young. I didn't know what I was doing.
So I'm going to jump back and forth between a couple of things.
Go for it.
You just mentioned what was it? A show. We were talking about like what's big in Britain, and a lot of the popular culture around geekdom or around D&D centers around a certain comedy aspect, and that comedy aspect has a huge influence from Canadians and Americans knowing every line of Monty Python. And
yes.
I thought I could take it one level more going, well, since my mom is actually British, I was raised on the Carry On Gang and and Benny Hill, and my brother, my older brother, watches Little Britain. And I've mentioned this to like everybody British that I meet, anyone in the UK and Scotland. I'm like, oh, actually, you know, on my dad's side, I'm one quarter Scot and this type of thing. And not a flag waving thing. I just want them to be more comfortable with me. And I want them to know that right away, if they slip into slang, I can actually understand it. When we used to play Xbox back in the day, we had a Canadian, American, and British group, and I could play with one or the other. And I noticed the Americans, the British didn't like, they had their little buddies, and like when you're shooting on Call of Duty, but the way they would communicate with the slang doesn't go well. It's very choppy over the net, and they didn't understand each other. And I found myself being like this live narration going, you know, he'd say this, and I'm like, he means that to the US guys. Yeah. Or even the US would say something, I'm like, this means this to the British guys. And I was like this it was like this coach or something. It was funny.
I am actually fascinated by all that stuff. I'm very much in love with American culture and all the different American things. I just lap up as much of that as I can, to the point where I know all of the Yiddish words that you get in American TV and what they mean, because I look them up. I'm like, just that language and language differences, I'm just fascinated by.
Oh yeah, no, I agree. Like I love languages. I love using languages in game. People are like, oh no, I don't want to roll to know if he's speaking Dwarven. Just what is it in common? What is it? No, I actually love it. And with my cast, it's a joke because I actually mutilate the English language. My brain works so much faster than my mouth can, and I will mutilate words, and they call them Jeffisms. Just having a Jeffism, because I'll either make up a word or I'll just put words together, and they just kill themselves laughing. They even hate it when I speech to text them because it never comes out quite right, which is funny because for someone that you think like ourselves that might become gramandos and, you know, really like the literature of the, you know, no, I'm saying that you can love something without necessarily being good at it. You know, like I'm a podcaster that doesn't speak English very well. That's kind of funny to me. Like, I hope you know, like, you know what I mean. Like, and I'm the GM. I run the games, and I'm not the most affluent enunciation type person, unless I'm in a character, right? So anyway, sorry again. We're getting a little off content. So in a roundabout way, what I was trying to get to ask you is, as I'd mentioned, as I met some of the European content creators, I'm always like, oh yeah, Benny Hill, blah blah. You know, like, please don't judge me as just some guy that knows everything of Python, because I know you guys are tired of that. Love Python. But the fact that North Americans, Canadian and America, just go on and on and on about it, right? You're the first person I've ever met that just kind of went, well, you know, Little Britain and Benny Hill, and they're good and they have their culture, but they're not as big over here as you might think. And I was like, really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really weird where you can always kind of tell when it's the weirdest thing. So we get a lot of American TV in the UK. So I've seen every single episode of Friends, for example.
Sure.
So Friends is like a staple in the UK. It's like everybody knows Friends.
Okay.
And Friends is also was a big phenomenon in America. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes you get this weird thing when like David Hasselhoff was really big in Germany. And like Americans are just like, well, we like David Hasselhoff, but do we like him Germany amounts? Like, you don't, you know. So Benny Hill like had his moments back in the 70s, I think it was. Mm-hmm. But that was before my time. So I never watched Benny Hill on TV. And when I did see it, I was like, so he's running very fast and they're playing saxophone music. Okay, interesting. And then I'm watching V for Vendetta, and it's set in the UK, but it's made by two Americans, the Wachowskis, and it's full of these little moments where you're just like, sometimes they get it right, and you're like, oh yeah, that's a thing we say, that's great. Mm. Then every now and again, it's like, interesting. Like, V makes for Evie, Natalie Portman's character, he makes her egg in a basket with a slice of bread, and you cut the hole in the middle and you put a fried egg in the middle, and we don't have that in this country. Like, I make it because I love eggs, but nobody, I've asked people like, hey, if you know this recipe, egg in a basket, then like, what are you talking about? But these days, like, yes, egg in a basket, would you like some? And he's like, oh wow, you know. So it's, that's weird. And then they have like a UK comedy show with Stephen Fry as the presenter. Stephen Fry, we love Stephen Fry in this country. He's like our national treasure, you know, he's like our chief export. And if you listen to the Harry Potter audiobooks in this country, they're all read by Stephen Fry, and he does a fantastic job. He does all the voices. And so I love seeing Stephen Fry on the show. I was like, oh, brilliant. Stephen Fry is a comedy satirist like Stephen Colbert in the V for Vendetta universe. I love it. But then all the comedy they do is American comedy that you would never see on UK primetime TV. And then they cut to Benny Hill and starts playing Yakety Sax, and everyone's running around really quickly. And I'm just like, am I having a stroke? What is this?
It's not so the way weird. We think. Yeah. There is something, I guess, lost, even though it's English to English, there is something that's lost in translation. And have you ever set up a computer and it says UK English, Australian English, or American English? Right?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, we're not weird enough to get Canadian English in there. We don't count. Okay. You know, I mean, even the guys, even my cast were half American, half Canadian, and the sorry and sorry and about and a boot, you know, they won't let it go. And we're like, oh, wow, you picked two words. You know, there's so much diversity in Canada. There's so much of a melting pot of diversity in the States. And what I love about Europe and yourself is you guys are plugged into what's going on over there. North America is so vast and so much going on in Hollywood. They really don't see beyond their border. unless something, you know what I mean? Like there's Spanish television and then there's UK TV and stuff getting piped to us, but they have to have a personal cultural, you know, mom or grandma came over on the boat like myself to be invested in that. And then, you know, you think you're all up on it, you know, and then you meet someone from the homeland and you're like, no, dude, no. Have you ever seen it? In a nutshell, because we'll move on to the next question. Have you ever seen the movie with George Clooney and Matt Damon? And it's World War II and they're running around trying to collect art that's got picked up by the Nazis.
Oh, I've never seen it. I remember. Yeah.
It's an all-star cast, and they need someone that speaks French. And Matt Damon is from Canada, Quebec, Canada, and speaks Quebecois French. And they stick him with the Frenchman, and everyone's away, and he's alone, and he's sitting there with the Frenchman, and he's talking to him, and he's like, okay, how good's your French? And he starts speaking, and they subtitle the translation of what his French sounds like in France. And he sounds really bad. He sounds like he's not right in the head. And the guy's like, you know what? Shut up. You're going to get us both killed. Don't say anything. And this look on Matt Damon's face, like the entire reason he was hired was because he speaks French, and it got killed in 2 seconds. But to me, that's funnier than, you know, three glasses and you're supposed to not do three because the Germans use their thumb for 1, 2, 3. And, you know, next thing you know, it's a slaughterhouse. I find that little difference. I find it interesting. I find it entertaining. I guess we shouldn't go on about it too much.
Well, so, I think that sometimes, you're getting a little bit of echo on my end. I can kind of hear my,
it's a little bit of a, do you have a favorite class, a race, an alignment when you play D&D, a personality? Like you have your cast of characters in your comic and they're all playing D&D and such. Do you have your own personal favorite?
Yeah.
Something that's either a trope, whether it's a personality type or even a race or class or something, it's your go-to?
Actually, that's funny because the comic, Life on the Fourth Floor, is just, it's life. It's just, it's, so I put geeky things in there because for me, that's just part of life. So it's a comic that's a hodgepodge of everything. It's about relationships. Sometimes it's about video games, but it's not a video game comic. Mm-hmm. Just they sometimes play video games. I didn't think it was a big deal. Like, I started this back in 2005. So this was before Big Bang Theory came along and they were like, oh, look at us, you know, we're geeks and we were in a sitcom. But I was trying to do that back in 2005.
It's like your version of Friends. Doing all these different things. Can you give us sort of like a takeaway before we get in too much detail? Because I guess it's my bad. I never said, like, you know, what's the title of comic? What's the setting? I guess we should ask you before you get into the narrative.
Yeah, so I realized that, you know, so the comic is Life on the Fourth Floor, which you can find at fourthfloorcomics.com. And it's fourth as in the word fourth, not the number fourth floor. But if you just Google Life on the Fourth Floor, it's the first thing that comes up. So Life on the Fourth Floor is literally about a bunch of people and they live on the fourth floor of a apartment block or a block of flats. And you can, I don't mind which you use, apartment or flat is fine by me. So they all live together. And so it's basically about roommates or flatmates, as we would call them, in their 20s. And they're just kind of coping with life and creativity. Like, one of them is a novelist who writes fantasy novels. One of them is a cartoonist, but no one reads his comic. One of them does internet reviews, and she's like a pop culture critic, kind of like Lindsay Ellis type archetype. And there's one who's just a social media influencer and Instagram model, who's just the worst, and they just all kind of annoy each other in different ways. So I always wanted, because I was inspired by PvP, and PvP actually was my first exposure to D&D, because they had a comic, they had a storyline in PvP where they were all playing D&D, and you got to see them as their characters in the world of the game. I always thought that was really cool, where you could just be playing a game and your characters would be there and they look different because they're in the game. You can't really do that in live action. You know, you can't have someone just become an elf or become a dwarf. I thought that was really cool. I always wanted to do one of those. So right now I'm running a storyline where everyone's playing, not D&D, they're playing Labyrinth Lord, a retro clone of D&D. It's first edition D&D. And there's a joke in there about how, like, it sounds fake. It sounds like something you'd make up for a sitcom, but it's actually a real game that you can download and play for free, which I think is really cool. So all my games that I run are Labyrinth Lord games. So I wanted to do a Labyrinth Lord storyline where everyone's there as their characters. So right now they're all playing Labyrinth Lord.
I'm sorry, Labyrinth Fort?
Labyrinth Lord.
Oh, yeah, Labyrinth
so Lord. LL, Labyrinth Lord.
Sorry, Labyrinth Lord. No, it's just we're going on so fast. A quick interjection. It is Attack of Opportunity. I'm allowed to do this, sorry. Have you ever seen Darkness Rising, where they actually did a live action of doing exactly what you said, and they had one guy playing a sorceress, and because he was in love with his gorgeous math teacher, they got that actress to play the sorceress? So when he was in character, they had this gorgeous blonde in a red dress being the sorceress. But when he did player things, like got creepy with it or turned it hit on the female player or whatever, it was this guy in this little in the dress. Like they put the actual actor, you know, this cringy little dude in the dress sitting there, and, you know, talking. And it was it was really really good. I thought, like you said, it was so brilliant that you could do that flip. So I'm not trying to prove you wrong in your point. But there are some that have aspired to try to do that, just that.
It's become like this well-worn thing. Like,
But what about your own?
They play D&D on Community, and
what about your own personal like race class when you're playing like with Jason back in the day or something that's carried into maybe into your comic? Do you have your own personal favorite when you're gaming at home, kind of thing?
Yeah, Bard. I really love playing a Bard, I actually started a D&D game with my friends for my bachelor party, my stag do, and so we had a very stag themed D&D game, and I rolled a character called Actaeon, because Actaeon's in Greek mythology, gets turned into a stag, so that was my little joke. So he's Actaeon, and he was a bard. And he was smooth talking. I've dumped everything into charisma. He had insanely high charisma, and he could talk himself out of any situation. But he was terrible at fighting and not very good at magic. And he was generally just kind of useless. But he was the leader. He was the self-appointed leader of the group. And so I liked him because he was very much a kind of a light relief kind of character. Kind of if ever there was any time to do any kind of role playing or talking, everyone else was their first D&D game. They were quite shy. So actually, he would stride forward and be like, "Hey, it's okay, guys. I've got this." It was my finest hour with that character before the campaign ended and he retired. Was my finest hour was when we broke into a dwarven treasure vault, like a bank vault. And we got past their deadly traps and we defeated an ogre. And then on our way out, all the guards rushed in and they're like, "What are you doing here?" And so I said, "Hey, don't worry, I've got this." And I drank a charisma potion and then I persuaded the dwarves with my insanely high persuasion rolls that we had been deliberately hired by the bank managers to break into the bank as like a white hat security test. We were testing the security.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's with sneakers.
And then
And then
I made a successful I made another check. I bluffed and said, "Actually, we haven't been paid yet. Can you pay us for robbing the bank vault?" And I rolled a 20. I got a natural 20. And so they paid me money for breaking into their vault. That was my finest hour.
I have got to tell my cast that's the best. That's gonna be like one of the best role playing into or dice roll and then out of a happy result of a natural 20 that I've like ever heard. I thought I was sitting on a story. I've got a reverse story about a natural one where I was playing with just my wife and one other friend. We're doing something quick and dirty, and I'm NPCing the dwarven rogue, and they're in a goblin cave, and all this stuff's going on. And the little buggers open up like there's like an underground dam. And they come down these stairs into a natural cavern that's round. And there's like a tide mark that's green. And they're looking at it. They can't quite figure it out. And there's a bunch of stairs going up. It's like, we'll go left or right. If you go right, you find a dam. With goblins going high, and they open the gates. If you go left, you go all the way down. And then you find this round, depressed bowl of a cavern with a hole in it. And that's like a drain. So they're down there, right? And the dwarf literally has his head, you know, because they're like, "Okay, rogue. Because it's NPC, I don't do stuff. They tell me what to do." Goes to carry on the hole, see what's going on. We'll look around, right? So anyway, we always played around with this language barrier, and I was having guys making, you know, roles for the elven to dwarven, no one to common kind of thing, just dicking around. They hear the water coming all of a sudden, this roar, and they're trying to figure it out, and then it dawns on them, and they go, "Oh my God." So they hit him on the back, you know, and just yell at him over his shoulder into the hole that he's looking in, and it's like, "Run now." You're like, "You got to run now," you know, and they take off, right? And he rolls a natural one. So I decided this guy, like plumber, like with his head in the hole, and someone pats him on the back, "You stay here." You know, they were like, They boot it all the way back to that stairwell and get up the stairs just in time to see a wall of water, you know, like go by. And they're just like, they just started mourning my dwarf, like, oh my, you know. I had this, the dwarf did a bunch of rolls. He climbed the wall above the water line, survived, came back dripping wet, and punched them right in the face when he caught up with them. Oh, he just followed the bodies, you know. And I was so proud of that story of a natural one and flipping. But dude, I got to tell you, hats off to you. I give you the award because that has got to be the best. Oh man, that's so good. So a couple of quick questions as we're wrapping up here because we're getting to time. I like to ask where you create your content from. Do you have a studio office? Are you at home? Do you go into work and, you know, like at UK studios, something? Where's the magic happen?
No, for the most part, I'm a stay at home dad. Mm-hmm. So I spend a lot of my time looking after my two children, especially recently, what with the whole situation. Mm-hmm. So schools are closed. So we're homeschooling our son right now. He's 4 and my daughter is 1.5. So they keep me plenty busy during the day. And then at night, after they go to bed, I just sit and hunch over my Wacom tablet and I just draw the comic in my spare time, awesome. What little ever I have.
Now, I would say, how long have you been making content? But you said 2005? How long have you been making this
2005,
content?
2005, so it's been 15 years.
Is this your only show? Do you have any other comics or any other content that you expose to the world?
Not yet. I've got a couple of other projects that I am working on, but I think it's a lot of those aren't going to see the light of day until my kids are a little bit older, like maybe when they're both at school, and I've got a little bit more free time around the house. Right now I'm within the kind of the sleep deprivation and the constantly having to chase the baby that's escaping out of the room. And she tries to put herself into the dishwasher kind of thing. You have to try and get her out before she closes the dishwasher door, that kind of thing. So that's my life right now. So it's sitting down to write a fantastic novel. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to get a good flow in that kind of situation. Okay. So right now it's just the webcomic. I've just kind of put all of my energy into trying to make it the best webcomic that it can be. I spent a lot of time writing it and improving the art
and
stuff.
It's really good. Yeah. I gotta ask, is there like that story, your shining moment in D&D, does any of that go into the comic? Like, have you actually done something in real life with your guys or that story you just told and have it sort of happen in the comic just because it was too good not to?
Yeah. I mean, what I do with the comic is I write the story and I basically sit down and I write a 26 minute sitcom episode. And I pace it and I structure it like a sitcom. Mm. And then I break it up into the individual pages. So the idea is when you go through the archives and you read a chapter, that chapter is going to be like sitting down to watch an episode of a sitcom, like watching an episode of Frasier or something, or like how I Met Your Mother. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm going for. So what I've recently done just in the past few years is I've taught myself how to be a DM. And I started DMing my own games. And it was the most fun I've ever had. And it's lovely just to make something where you're creating something, not because it's going to go on the internet. It's just for you and it's just for your friends, just to make something and put all that time into it, just so it can be something you just show to 5 people. There's something kind of special about that. It's like making a lovely home-cooked meal. I've been really enjoying that. But it can be frustrating when there's kind of clashes between players' egos, or when you make something and you accidentally make it a little bit too deadly and you accidentally kill a player. So that's just happened right now in the latest comic. The same player, Shivani, she's had her character die. Then she rolls a new character and then that character instantly dies again, because the dungeon master has just made it far too deadly. And so he's trying to get everyone together and he's trying to get them all to play nicely with each other, but they're pulling each other apart just because their personalities are clashing. That is very much drawn from real life, because it can be so frustrating when you just put all that work into something, you think, oh, this is going to be great, and then the players just completely circumvent it, or they just butt against it and they just die, and you're like, oh, I did not want you to die.
I gotta confess, that was the very first panel I saw. When I found you and found your webcomic, that was the very first panel I saw, and that's why I called you, because when I play with my guys, we have that happen all the time. There's always somebody going, but isn't there a penalty to that role? Because we try to play honestly. We don't try to like, oh, don't tell Jeff, haha, we got this.
Yeah, exactly.
Except Messina. You know, apparently he had a dwarf that takes this stance and he gives him bonuses, and he's like, I've been in that stance this entire time. Oh, like the entire dungeon, you know, instead of burning actions and move actions to like make it happen. He's like, yeah, I never got out of it. Like, you cannot do that. You know, it's like, oh, I'm watching you. Right. But usually the guys are all like, even on themselves, they'll call themselves on rules. So it's fair because they don't want to cheat the game to win. They want to beat the game. And I'm not talking like min maxing. I mean, you know what I mean? Like they'll remind each other and me of rules. So we got this open rule or anything. I still get, you know, last take. But so when I saw that, oh, what do you do? I die. Don't worry. Make up a new character. And she gets all excited. She's like, oh, check this out. And she's talking. And as she describes her character in the panel, suddenly you see the character marching down the hall. And then some player's like, hey, wait a minute. Isn't that hallway trapped still? And all of a sudden, whomp. And it's just like, oh, man. I almost dropped my phone. I was laughing so hard. And I was like, oh, yeah, I got to meet this guy.
Oh, thank you.
We've been talking to David J. Bishop, who, in my opinion, is far, far, far more talented than David Bishop. But don't tell him I said that. He's, you know, he's waiting for his interview. On Attack of Opportunity, trying to get to know a different type of content creator, still into fantasy. Obviously, we're still talking about D&D because you write a D&D comic. But like I said, perhaps a little bit influence about the Friends TV show has been big in the UK, is a little bit of an influence there. But definitely, you can jump right into any panel, and it's going to make, as embarrassed as you are, it's going to make you want to go back and read this from the very, very beginning.
Oh, please don't.
So last question, where can we find you online? Where can we find you on Twitter? Are you on Instagram besides your own website? You know, where on social media and websites can we find you and your content?
I am on Twitter. I've been using Twitter since like only a couple of years after Twitter started. So at the time, what you did was you got yourself a handle, like a gamer handle. And that's what you were online as. People weren't online as their own selves. People didn't have their own personal brand they were building. So when I created my Twitter handle, I was like, okay, at Oven Ready. Yeah, that's my gamer handle. You know, like when they unplug me from the Matrix and they give me my call sign, they'll be like, you're Cypher, you're Morpheus, you're Neo. And then who are you? I'm Oven Ready. Like, I thought that 16-year-old me thought that was a really good handle to have.
I'm telling you, that is so, real. Is that still you? Please tell me that's still your handle, because that is awesome.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I've had that handle since like 2007 or something. So I'm not going to drop it now. Yeah, so on Twitter, I'm at Oven Ready, like a chicken. And then one time, a bunch of wine mums in Texas started sending me messages. They started atting me because they'd just been to like a home seminar where they were like, they did like a sales pitch, like a Tupperware party, but for chicken. They were all sold ovens and they were all trying to use the hashtag Oven Ready, but they didn't know how hashtags work, so they all started atting Oven Ready. So I got all these really confusing messages from all these housewives in Texas who were telling me how they were going to baste a delicious chicken. And I was like, what?
No, that's great. So now you're all good friends and trading recipes, and you know, like, just that kind of happenstance, that kind of happy accident is can be one of the best things that can actually happen, honestly, on the internet. Everyone's got one of those stories. I feel we're gonna have to have you back on the show. I feel we've barely scraped the surface here with Mr. Bishop, but thank you so much for being on the show today. I'm GM Jeff Ball, your host, and
I would love to come back.
Yeah, we will definitely have you back in the future. But, you know, I guess that's just inspiration. Maybe you got to start something else, man. Like maybe an actual another comic or something when the kids are grown, or, you know, something. But we'll have to peel some more layers back from our love of Terry Pratchett.
So, and,
go on.
I'm on Twitter as Oven Ready. Mm. And my website is fourthfloorcomics.com. Mm-hmm. And also, my other claim to fame is that I did the logo for a D&D podcast called Flintlocks and Fireballs, which is a UK podcast.
I know that one.
And they are currently
I know that one. Sorry.
That the fireball and the flintlocks either side of it, I drew that. That was me. And so the guy who's the DM for that podcast, Jason, that's my Jason who DM'd my Stag Do. He's we've been best friends since 1996. And he's so I knew him when before he became famous. Those are the two places where you can find me on their logo and my website, Fourth Floor Comics.
See, now what this he's doing now, that's not name dropping. He knows the guy. He's excited to know the guy. He obviously supports him and charged him probably 200 quid for the art because, you know, the guy's got to eat. I don't consider that name dropping. You're genuinely excited to know these guys, that they're doing well, and like, hey, look at this. I was a part of this thing that people might identify with. So I'm not going to call you a name dropping. I just think you're really excited that you think it's cool. So, again, thank you so much for being on the show. We'll definitely have you back, and we will see you next time on Attack of Opportunity. Say goodnight, David Bishop.
Good fun, thank you. Good night, and well met.
So is there, like, something when you end an audio check? Like toast? Buttered toast? Scrape the toast. There's no more toast. There's no more toast.
Toast? No, I think you just see a rat and then you let go of the rope and then the alarms go off, right? That's just
just like in the movie.